anything else we can think of. And be sure to visit our webpage for this particular episode, where you'll find links to Canopy and Jeff's website and other things. Also, while you're looking at the website, perhaps you could give a thought to supporting the station by using that little bar across the top of the page for your contribution. So, something to think about, and until next week, keep watching the screens.
Donate to KBOO.
Support KBOO.
Give to KBOO now. Help KBOO reach our spring fundraising goal of $80,000 by May 31st. Give a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member for less than $2 a month.
Got some extra funds you can donate right now? Then go to kboo.fm today and click on the donate button.
Join the thousands of KBOO members who believe in volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio today.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Lynn Ballen, producer of Feminist Magazine, heard on KPFK in Los Angeles, and this is From the Vault. This week, I'm sitting in for Brian DeShazor to introduce a retrospective on radical feminism. This program was broadcast in 1980. When women were working to get the Equal Rights Amendment ratified in Congress. It failed in 1982. This program is also part of our current preservation and access project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. It's funded in part by a grant from the NHPRC at the National Archives called Documenting Democracy, Access to Historical Records. And now, a Pacifica Radio 1980 retrospective on radical feminism.
There was this hiatus between the past and the present, as though as soon as we came of age, history began.
Activist Alex Kate Shulman, author of Memoirs of an Ex-Prom Queen and Burning Questions.
It's really urgent.
It was a really important process in the women's movement. To discover the past.
Exactly, and it's still going on. And what's so shocking to me now is not only that we are cut off from our predecessors, but worse, in a sense, people who are just coming of age now in the late 70s have no idea of what went on in the late 60s during the women's liberation movement. There are myths that abound about what feminism was about, what the women's liberation movement was for, all kinds of terrible slanders, like that it was a bunch of storm-trooping maniacs, bra burners is the term, in combat boots, and that has nothing to do with our lives now.
Contemporary media would have us believe that the women's movement either stemmed from the suffrage movement at the turn of this century or sprang full-blown from malcontents in the late 60s. Further, the media would have us believe that there are no radical feminists today and that the movement is comprised of women who want to reform the system from within. This treatment of feminists is not new. Through the centuries, the woman question has been rather superfluously addressed. not only by those in relative positions of power, but by social change movements. By the 19th century, however, utopian ideas of the family and trade unionist perceptions of women's work began to ferment in the left and in the newly found suffrage movement. Women in the suffrage movement began to define the woman question strictly in terms of women, eventually narrowing it to the single issue of the vote. Women on the left consistently saw the issue in a much broader context. Sheila Robotin, in her book Women, Resistance, and Revolution, commented that for a black woman in the Civil War in America, for a French woman in one of the revolutionary moments, or for an early woman trade unionist, to confine their conception of the oppression they resisted simply to their gender was absurd. With the suffrage movement concentrating on the vote, radical women in the early 1900s continued to articulate the basic conditions of women's lives. Anarchist Emma Goldman challenged the state's right to control the personal and reproductive lives of women. Jane Addams, a socialist best known for her settlement homes, tied women into almost every social issue, from justice to international peace. And Communist Party members like Ella Reeve Bloor and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn organized women in a vast variety of jobs.
Elizabeth was a woman who couldn't be kept down. She was an organizer who roamed from town to town, fighting with her sisters out on the picket line, building up a future. Elizabeth seized the time like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who never did give in. Gonna build the revolution, then you know we're gonna win.
Throughout the first part of this century, women tackled their economic position with increased activity in labor unions. Women initiated strikes, set up soup kitchens, provided child care, organized wives, mothers, and sisters, and walked picket lines in actions that led to the unions today. The great General Motors sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan in 1937 gave the embryonic CIO a major impetus. Women organized an emergency brigade and mobilized the community of Flint, Michigan to support the men and women sitting down in General Motors Fisher body plants. One woman from the emergency brigade talks about that experience.
During that night, the radio was broadcasting to the people of the city of Flint. A riot, a revolutionary situation's broken out in Flint at the scene of Chevrolet Avenue in front of Fisher Body Number 2. And the streets are barricaded. Police were firing at us. And we were down here, being like this. And the people of Flint lined up on both sides of the barricade. When this happened, we had only the sound car broadcasting to those people. We had nobody on our side. And Victor Reuther and many of the others were there that night on the sound car, the men. And finally, Victor came up to us and he says, well, he said, you know, maybe we're going to have to lose this battle, but we won't lose the war. He said, but the batteries on the sound truck are running down. And I said, oh, let me speak then, Victor. And he looked at me and he said, well, I guess it can't hurt any. So I got up on the sound car and I was desperate. I thought, oh, boy, this is a key fight. It's going to ruin our morale here in Flint. And they were holding up their ends in other parts of the country. We were getting reports, and we didn't want to lose that battle. And I got up there, and I said, people of the city of Flint, and I could even feel the hush and the darkness, and everything quieted down. I said, people of the city of Flint, did you know that women are down here in the heart of this battle being fired upon? But, of course, if the cops are cowards enough to fire into the bellies of unarmed men, of course they're cowards enough to fire into the bellies of mothers of children. And that was too much for that day. You know, a mother was supposed to be honored, even if you exploited hell out of her. Well, she was supposed to be honored because she was a mother. And then I said, I appeal to you women of the city of Flint to break through those lines of police and come down here and stand beside your fathers, your husbands, and your brothers, or your sweethearts. And I it was such a great, great thrill, because there were women who did, and one cop pulled a woman's coat right off her when she went out of that coat and started marching down. And as soon as women started marching down into the center of the battle, the police didn't want to be accused of firing into the backs of unarmed women, God forbid. And that wound up the battle that night.
After World War II, in the competition for jobs, women were pushed aside. A new national Cold War mentality and McCarthyism peaked. Women were urged to return to the home. Although women comprised 40% of the labor force, the image of super housewife became the middle class ideal.
I got married in 1950, and at the very same time I left the job.
Well, why did you do that?
Well, I didn't even question it at the time. It just seemed like the appropriate thing to do. I was replacing one thing with another. I was going to be a wife and set up a sweet little house, and my husband was going to get a job and support us. I mean, it was just a classic magazine idea.
But your husband didn't have a job at that point.
No. When we got married, he was unemployed and I was employed. And I left my job, and he put himself under a tremendous strain to try to get a job, and it took him a long time to get a job. And we just totally reversed the circumstance.
Well, what did you live on while he was looking for a job and you quit your job?
Well, we lived on savings. We lived on my savings and also some of his savings.
But you thought of yourself as a modern couple at that point.
Yes, well, that was what was such an anomaly, because I was supposed to be home because I was supposed to be taking care of the house, and my husband was home because he didn't have a job. Mm-hmm. So the two of us used to sit at this little table looking out over Second Avenue and 18th Street and watching the traffic go by and commenting on the state of the world and considering ourselves very urbane and sophisticated.
Women did not start actively organizing again until the late 1950s with the burgeoning civil rights movement in the South. In the book They Should Have Served That Cup of Coffee, Seven Radicals Remember the 60s, Bernice Reagan, a longtime radical activist, says that you cannot present an accurate picture of the movements of the 60s and 70s unless you show them resting on the foundation of the civil rights movement. Many black and white women came to the civil rights movement with a sense of moral outrage and with the idea of building what they called a beloved community, an egalitarian and ethical society. They soon became radicalized as they saw Southern blacks confront an unyielding and brutal power structure. Many of the major leaders of the civil rights movement were women who endured incredible hardships. Fannie Lou Hamer was one of those women. In 1964, she was arrested in Mississippi for her voter registration activities. In this interview in 1966, she describes what happened.
And then three white men came to my cell. And one of them was a state highway patrolman because he was wearing a little silver plate across his pocket that said John L. Bassinger. And he asked me where I was from, and I told him I was from Louisville. And he said, I'm going to check that. And he went out, and I guess he called Louisville. And they didn't like me in Louisville because I worked with voter registration there. And when he came back, he said, you damn right, you said, you're from Louisville, all right, and we gonna make you wish you was dead. And they led me out of that cell into another cell, and he gave a Negro prisoner a blackjack, and he ordered me to lay down on a bunk bed. And a Negro prisoner said, do you want me to beat her with this, sir? And he said, you damn right, because if you don't, you know what I'll do for you. And I laid down on the bunk like he ordered me to do. And the first Negro beat me. He beat me until he was exhausted. And after he beat, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. And during the time he was beating, I began to work my feet because that was a horrible experience. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro that had beat to sit on my feet while the second one beat. And I just began to scream where I couldn't control it. And then the white man got up and began to beat me in my head. I have a blood clot now in the artery to the left eye and a permanent kidney injury on the right side from that beating. These are the things that we go through in the state of Mississippi, just trying to be treated like a human being. But still, this is called a part of America. What I'm curious to see, do the Constitution of the United States mean anything? So far, it hadn't worked, and I'm sick of seeing this kind of stuff on paper. We want them to do something about it because we are a part of America, because we didn't come here on our own. Our parents and our descendants was from Africa, and we didn't come on our own, but we do want to be treated as human beings. And I'm fighting for human right, not for eco right.
Fannie Lou Hamer in an interview in 1966. Fannie Lou Hamer died in 1977. Sarah Evans, in her book Personal Politics, noted that young women in the civil rights movement found that the risks of a direct action movement and the intense relationships that it generated became an exercise in self-discovery. For many women, that discovery continued in the early New Left movement. The Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, organized community action projects known as the Economic Research and Action Projects, ERAP. SDS women working in ERAP organized some of the most successful community actions. They were able to talk to poor women about the quality of women's lives in ways SDS men never could. Some of their efforts later evolved into the National Welfare Rights Organization. But as the New Left focused more and more on anti-war efforts, women were shoved aside. An autonomous women's movement started to emerge. Leslie Kagan was chairman of the New York University Committee to End the War in Vietnam and on the National Coordinating Committee of the Student Mobilization Committee. She describes the beginning of an autonomous women's movement.
Well, it's hard. One of the interesting things about chronicling the women's movement is that there aren't a set of specific dates. The things sort of happen over time and in a more mass kind of way. There's not like a founding convention that starts the women's movement. I think that one of the initial pushes for women to meet separately as women's groups actually was in the context of the anti-draft movement, when a lot of men, I know this happened to me personally also, when men said that even though we were active in the anti-war movement, that we could not speak at anti-draft meetings because we, as women, did not face the potential of being drafted. And so a lot of women said, okay, we'll go meet by ourselves. And that, in fact, some of it was in response to that kind of treatment by men. It wasn't so much the women got together and said, well, forget it, we're going to go meet by ourselves, but that there was no other place for us to meet. That was one root of that. I think on another angle that we come to this from is that women just feeling that they couldn't speak freely and openly in the presence of men. And in part, I think we're learning something off of the experience of black people and third world people in this country, that whenever there's a group of people and it's mixed, racially mixed, there is a power dynamic at play. And I think women understood that also and said, well, if we're going to come to terms with who we really are and explore that, we need to do it without men around.
Women meeting by themselves began to pinpoint central issues and to crystallize them into some of the early slogans of the women's movement. Equal pay for equal work. Women as sex object. The personal is political. The right to control your own body.
The thoughts in my head could reach a great distance and somehow get into your mind. They would tell you much more than all the words I could speak from now till the end of time. Lady, now, are you a lady? Do you like the one your beauty's been sold to? How does it feel?
Women began meeting in their kitchens, in their living rooms, around the coffee table to discuss the problems of being a woman. Cynthia Funk was a member of Women's Liberation Group No. 3 in New York City.
It was either late 67 or 68 that the group formed. And formed by grapevine, word of mouth, I had a friend who was aware of a Women's Liberation Group that was Group No. 2 that had gotten too big. And the idea was that when a group got too big, somebody in that group volunteered to start a new group. And my friend had learned that that was going to happen, and she offered to have the meeting at her house and told me about it, and I got very excited and went. Most of the women in the group I was first in were with men. I remember much of the criticism was that everybody hated men, and that these women had to be very weird. And we really weren't very weird. We were very different from one another in many ways. Some women very well educated and some not. Some women quite from backgrounds which were affluent, and many from backgrounds which were not affluent at all. Many of the women in the group were very left-oriented, and then there were others, such as myself, who were there because we were interested in the concept of women's liberation and didn't really understand a lot of the lefty rhetoric which we were confronted with for a long time. You know, the truth is, we didn't know how to define ourselves. The movement was so young, we didn't even perceive of ourselves as a movement. We were just very excited to be able to be in touch with other women who perceived that something was wrong with the state of woman. And we had many debates. You know, the way that the media would presented us sounded as though we really had our act together. And I suppose in some respects we did, but we debated things like whether or not to use the word feminism. At the time we were first getting going, women's liberation wasn't even an accepted idea in the press. And very quickly, the idea of women's liberation and the term feminism began getting very widely used and accepted. But we were very, very uncertain as to what our course was, what it should be, to what extent we should work on being a sort of private support group for one another, as opposed to making public demonstrations which would call attention to the ideas, how we should proceed in our personal and public lives was really a complete mystery, and we had no real guideline.
In 1968, the Women's Liberation Group No. 3 held a demonstration against the Miss America pageant in Atlantic City. It was one of the first public outcries against the use of women as sex objects, and it received national press coverage.
The demonstration itself was not nearly as sensational as the press wrote it up to be. For instance, we never burned anything, and the headlines afterwards were that there were bra burning. We did have a little skit that involved a trash can in which women circled around a large trash can and put things into it that we figured symbolized various elements of women oppression, but we never burned anything. And much of the coverage was very, very sensational and didn't have anything to do with us or who we were and what we thought we were doing. And so we were presented to be much more scary and hateful than we in fact were. One of the women in our group was arrested at the Miss America demonstration for disorderly conduct. She had gone around the convention center spraying a smell that smelled a lot like Tony hairspray, and she was arrested for emitting a noxious odor. And some of the other women were arrested for putting out the big banner at the time Miss America was chosen, which said Women's Liberation on it. We organized that. Our group needed to raise money after the Miss America contest for what we anticipated might be very heavy legal fees, and Halloween was coming up. The Miss America contest was in September, and so Halloween was coming up not long after that. And we got the idea of doing something with respect to Halloween to raise money, and so started researching about Halloween. And of course, the witches emerged from that research, and a number of us got very excited about the history of witches, and we changed the name of our group to Witch, which had a number of different things it stood for. One of the things it stood for was, which the press picked up and pushed, was Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, which made us sound very dramatic and really didn't have very much to do with what we were about.
I feel that the effect of the Miss America demonstration was much more important than the demonstration itself. The demonstration itself was riddled with many faults. But in New York, we had three little groups going, and we got together and did this demonstration, and then the next open meeting for women who were interested in women's liberation was mobbed. And it was really from that point that the idea caught on, and many groups formed very, very quickly after that demonstration and moved the movement on with great spirit.
As the 1970s opened, radical women found themselves working in activities which stemmed from their early discussions and actions. Free daycare, safe birth control, abortion rights, all became issues around which to organize. Intense personal relationships developed between women who saw their political and personal lives merge.
Touch me, away.
An army of lovers, said Rita Mae Brown, cannot fail. Other women articulated an even more definitive analysis. They asked, how can a woman rail against a male-dominated power structure and still maintain a relationship with a man? Within a few years, lesbianism had become an issue for the women's movement. At a National Now conference, Betty Friedan denounced lesbians as a lavender menace. Joan Byron, a longtime Washington, D.C. activist, was a member of the Furies, one of the first radical lesbian separatist groups.
In 1970 and at the beginning of 71, Sharon Devey and Charlotte Bunch and I were all very active in what was then called the Women's Liberation Movement in Washington. We were among the organizers of various projects and worked out of the office on Biltmore Street and had been working on abortion, birth control, child care, and a number of other issues which were not necessarily, although in some cases they were, primary issues for us as lesbians, and said, listen, there are other things that we wish to discuss in the context of a liberation movement for women. One of that is that heterosexuality gives heterosexual women certain privileges which are not available to lesbian women. And then the lesbian, because she is willing to say, I do not need a man, or I do not want a man to protect me or to use me, by saying that I'm a lesbian, I am saying I am willing to present myself to the world as a woman alone, or a woman who is willing only to take energy and give energy to other women. If I am going to be discriminated against and harassed and oppressed, then so is every other woman. A group of us decided to live and work together and form a separate lesbian feminist, radical lesbian feminist collective because of our frustrations in dealing with the women who we had been working with who were threatened by our lesbianism, who were not prepared at that point either to be questioned about the amount of time and energy that they were devoting to men, or who did not want to deal with our complaints about our own oppression within the women's movement and the fact that issues that were important to us were not being dealt with. And we experienced, and people talk, you know, about gay, straight splits in a rather theoretical way, but it was not just theoretical. I mean, these were women that we had been working with very closely. We were very dear personal friends with them. And then suddenly, when we became lesbians, things would happen like they would call up the husbands, the ex-husbands, and offer their condolences to them and not speak to us. And it was very painful. And it wasn't so much that the lesbians rejected the straight women as that there was a total gap, or, you know, the split was just that there was no way that we were talking about the same politics. And it was important for us in the Furies, the first thing we wanted to do was make it clear to people that lesbianism was a political choice and not just a personal sexual preference. We were very, very militant. We were not at all apologetic about being lesbians. We had no shame about announcing that we were lesbians, and people were just not prepared to deal with this. It was a very extreme position, and it needed to be extreme at the time, and I think it was the fact that it was so extreme and so militant that made us have the kind of impact that we did, because we were operating at that time virtually in a total void. I mean, there were several other groups around the country, but very few. I mean, you're really talking, when you're talking about 1970-71, maybe there were 50 people nationwide who were saying these kinds of things, and you can imagine the isolation that we felt.
You are listening to A Retrospective on Radical Feminism, produced in 1980 by Moira Rankin and Deborah George for Sophie's Parlor Women's Collective, then part of a Pacifica station, WPFW in Washington, D.C. If you would like a copy of this program, please visit fromthevaultradio.org or call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now, back to the program.
Lesbian separatist groups like the Furies had a tremendous impact on their communities. Women became polarized around the lesbian issue, creating gay-straight splits. Eventually, the issue did become resolved, but not in terms of whether lesbianism was a correct political line, rather on the civil rights of lesbians and homosexual men. In 1977, at the United States International Women's Year Conference in Houston, Betty Friedan renounced her initial position on lesbians and spoke in favor of a sexual preference resolution.
I am Betty Friedan, delegate at large. Please stay in order. I am known to be violently...
Please stay in order, and will delegates please take their seats?
I am known to be violently opposed to the lesbian issue in the women's movement. And in fact, I have been. This issue has been used to divide us too much. It has been seized on. It has been seized on by the enemies of women's equality, and it has alienated many. As someone who has grown up in Middle America, as someone who grew up in Peoria, Illinois, and as someone who perhaps has loved men too well, I have had...
Please stay in order.
I have had trouble with this issue, as have many other women who grew up as I have. We have all made mistakes in our focus on this issue, but we have all learned. Now my passionate priority is ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, or we will lose all we have fought for in the last 15 years.
Please stay in order.
And because I know, as you know, that despite what our right-wing reactionary enemies say, there is nothing whatsoever in the Equal Rights Amendment that will give any protection to homosexuals, I believe that we must help the women who are lesbians be protected in their own civil rights.
Please stay in order. Will the delegate be advised her time is almost up?
And in the historic unity of this day, and because we will need every ounce of all our effort in the next 13 months to get the Equal Rights Amendment ratified, I suggest that you waste no further time in debating this issue and join with me in voting support of the resolution on sexual preference. Thank you.
Please stay in order.
Ms. Chair, I am Barbara Love, a proud lesbian delegate at large from New York State, and I move that we call the question.
Would all those in favor of the sexual preference resolution please rise?
It's carried. Carried overwhelmingly. There are thousands of helium balloons being released from the hall. They are floating to the ceiling. A vast majority of delegates are on their feet. They are on their chairs. They are cheering and waving signs and dancing in the aisles.
Radical feminists established a form of organization that borrowed heavily from the leftist cell structures. It gave them a clarity and drive that other women's groups had not experienced. Within a short period of time, women-only collectives and other kinds of structures began to form. Tactics also became an ever-increasing part of women's organizations. The Los Angeles Feminist Health Clinic began out of a discussion of women's right to control their own bodies. The women in the clinic focused on a number of ways to refine the issue, such as legalizing abortion and performing self-help for women. Carol Downer was one of the founders of that clinic.
I was part of the abortion task force of the Los Angeles Now chapter, and I spoke along with Lana Phelan about abortion. And I also was helping to put on a demonstration on abortion in Hancock Park. And it was at that period that the other women that I, was working with thought that maybe we would start an illegal abortion clinic. Maybe we would then, get arrested and that would cause the law to change or, something like that. So in the process of exploring that strategy, we learned, how to do abortions. But even more importantly, we learned how little we all know about our own bodies. It was through seeing, each other's cervixes and finding out how really, easy it was and how important it was for us to do this and how drastically it changed our consciousness of our own bodies and gave us the skills that we needed. In short, it just seemed to be a wonderful idea. So we called up the self-help clinic and we started going out to talk to other women's groups and share with them these ideas. And as you say, it was a very sound idea that people liked and spread very quickly. And it now is an established cornerstone, really, of the women's health movement. In 1972, Colleen Wilson and I were arrested for practicing medicine without a license. And Colleen had 11 counts, and I had one. These were misdemeanor counts. Now, her crimes consisted of helping to fit a diaphragm, pulling out an old Tampax, helping a woman with yogurt, such things as that. My crime was of helping to insert yogurt in another woman's vagina to help her to get rid of a yeast condition. So Colleen plea bargained, and she pled guilty to fitting a diaphragm, and we paid the $250 fine, and we went on and fought my case because it perfectly exemplified the issues that we wanted to fight for at that time, which was the right of women to examine our own bodies and use home remedies and to do it in a group setting. And we went to court, had a week-long trial, and we won. We won overwhelmingly.
I have miles of unclaimed pathways in the myriad of my mind. Moss covered stones of small beginnings left for dusty death to find. Seems I'm never where I plan to be. 3 miles along the line, and insistent voices call to me, reminding me of time.
Los Angeles Feminist Health Clinic went on to form a national network of health clinics. The network is indicative that short-term actions were not going to work and that the women's movement was in for a long haul. Rape crisis centers, legal defense funds, and women's centers became fixtures across the country. Women's centers in particular met with various degrees of success. Some focused on specific issues, like woman abuse or rape. Others emphasized basic skills and offered courses ranging from self-defense to carpentry and auto mechanics. But the women running the centers did not have the experience needed to provide answers for bread-and-butter questions, food, clothing, and shelter. Jerry Traina, an editor with Quest, a Feminist Quarterly, ran the Washington Area Women's Center in 1973. She talks about the frustration those early women felt in not being able to deliver basic services and how women need to broaden their impact.
None of us had been trained to all of a sudden be prepared to deal with, say, a welfare mother who walked into the women's center, and this happened to me, with four or five kids in tow who had been dismissed by any number of departments in the district government who said they couldn't deal with her. And she heard about the women's center and she came to us, and we would look with her and say, I don't know what to do. And we didn't know what to do. We weren't well versed in the way government, district government, any kind of government ran. Most of the women who were involved as volunteers in the women's center were volunteering because they wanted to help women, but they had no skills as far as figuring out how the system ran. And I guess maybe we have learned to some extent that even if you are against the system, you have to learn how the system works so that you can bring pressure and you can have clout and you can say, I know how you work, I know who the people are, who can make things happen, and that's the way I'm going to make this work so I can help these people. At that point in time, we didn't have any of that. And we were frustrated because we could not send people who came to us to the places where they would have resources that were real.
While women's centers struggled to supplement many women's needs, large institutions in this country began to listen and respond to women's demands. The Supreme Court legalized abortion in 1973. Children's books began to do away with sex role stereotyping. State legislatures funded retraining centers for displaced homemakers. Labor unions started to organize and admit more women. But even though these were important reforms that affected women's lives, women in the United States as a whole still constituted the largest single poverty group. Established women's lobbying groups started to expand their focus. The National Committee on Household Employment, long involved in the rights of domestic workers, broadened their efforts to include women in many occupations. In an interview in 1975, Edith Barksdale Sloan explains.
We know there are many women who are in the same position economically as household workers. And what we're trying to do is to show the public that this just isn't a unique problem to household workers, that there's similar groups around the country who have similar problems. For example, underemployment, unemployment, and the minimum wage, lack of adequate child care services, especially if you can't afford anything.
Right.
If you're making $2 an hour, you can't afford to pay anyone anything. The lack of adequate health services. If you can't get good preventive care, your health is going to fail, and usually fails in your middle years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're down and out and dependent upon the public assistance. And many of these women are working so hard because they're imbued with the work ethic, the Protestant work ethic. And they just want to make their own way, but everything is against them.
Right.
Food and inflation, what has happened there, and how difficult it is, impossible, to provide your family and yourself with an adequate diet on what you're making. Food stamps, even though Mr. Simon claims that is the biggest boondoggle going, we think it's very necessary. Because we have in our society people who are relegated to these positions where they can't make a decent salary, we need something like food stamps simply so they can exist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no more of a giveaway than what we do for industry. We give much more to industry than we can do ever to American citizens who are trying to make a living.
That's
in
right.
An inadequate economic situation. So therefore, we're going to talk about food stamps and how poor working women and men can't get them simply because they can't afford to take that day off and lose that day's pay to go and stand in line all day. And those places are only open from 9 to 5 or doing working hours 5 days a week when you have to be at work.
Right.
So you can't afford to go get them, so you can't get them, and therefore you can't use them, and you have to pay what everyone else pays, and this is very difficult. We're going to talk about the whole problem of women as heads of households and the rise of the single-parent household, and welfare is a woman's issue. And these are all very important, explosive issues, but they need to be heard.
I got to tell you that the blues they got in my pockets. I'll be alone with what I say. The bills are gonna rob me tomorrow. That's why I need my $10 today. You got me singing the
As women's communities continued to grow, becoming not only more knowledgeable but more numerous, they became the target of grand jury investigations, investigations which focused on a broad range of activity, criminal or not. It is ironic that although in the early 70s the press ridiculed the women's movement, by 1975 the government became extremely interested in the movement, which they perceived as a social change movement threatening the state. Grand jury investigations centered around the whereabouts of women being sought in connection with alleged anti-war activities. Jill Raymond was living in Lexington, Kentucky in 1974. The FBI thought that two women they were looking for, Susan Sachs and Catherine Powers, had lived in Lexington. When Jill Raymond and several others were subpoenaed by the grand jury in connection with that search, they refused to answer questions. For that refusal, Jill Raymond spent 14 months in jail. Here she talks about what the FBI was looking for and the women's movement connection to those anti-war women.
The FBI was going about compiling an analysis of a community and how it works. They were asking who hung out with who and where. In fact, one grand jury question was, they gave an address, and they said, name everybody you've ever seen at this address, who they were with, what was said there, what meetings were held there. Now, not only, you know, who could remember anything, although we come close to answering that question, but that says a whole lot about this as a fishing expedition for information way beyond the whereabouts of Susan Sachs and Kathy Power or anybody who had ever committed a crime. And it makes sense. The FBI would need to get an accurate understanding of how a community like the lesbian feminist community particularly operated, as opposed to old sort of traditional left groups dominated by or made up by men, particularly before the new left of the 60s, it was all very structured and very clear. But what would a straight, white, middle-aged male in 1970 know about how lesbian feminists operated? And that was clearly one of the things they were trying to understand. The women's movement has an interest in changing the state fundamentally. That is, it has an interest in, as other movements do, and what Susan's case did was it forced feminists to see that we as feminists could be victims directly and indirectly of the state, for things that went beyond our explicitly feminist acts, if you will, but which were a part of our feminist philosophy, our feminist desire for a different kind of world, if you will. The state, for its part, doesn't particularly care what our own little political hassles with each other are. It doesn't particularly care, for instance, about the split between separatists and straight women or the split between the women's movement and the left, except insofar as it can exploit it and use it to divide people off from each other. It's mostly interested, I think, about
people and perspectives that threaten it.
How far to cooperate within the system is a problem for many radical feminists. Yet another problem, and one far more tangible, is racism within the movement.
The divisions between black and white people in this country, and especially between black and white women, are very serious.
Donna Keck, one of the founders of Women, a Journal of Liberation. The journal has been published by women in Baltimore, Maryland for the past 10 years and covers the politics and culture of the women's movement.
I believe that white women have to actively attempt to work with black women, to make contact with black women and to find things that we have in common and that we can work on together. And that white women need to deal with racism in all the work that we do. In the Women's Union in Baltimore, where I am active, we're doing a project on violence against women. Women across the country have worked on these things. And we're, from the beginning of the, you know, putting together the project, we've been trying to talk about the issue of racism, because it's so easy for us to act in a way that blames black men, you know, that when you're dealing with the issue of violence, who comes out as the enemy are black men. And then that makes it very difficult for us to work with black women, because they want to support their black men and don't want to get caught in that bind. I think that we have good rhetoric, that white women have good rhetoric on the issue of racism, but not good practice, that we don't have the contacts with black women and we haven't been able to develop projects which allow us to work together.
Cynthia Washington is a black woman who has been active in both black and feminist movements.
I see the problem not just as problems of sexism and racism and classism, but as a proliferation of the criteria by which we distinguish us from them. And that distinction is the basis on which we compete in society for goods, services, turf, whatever. And the other isms are elitism, I mean that intellectually, heterosexism, professionalism, ageism, and it goes on and on and on. And the question I would like for us to discuss, if possible, is how these isms are confluent, some of them, and how they are divergent. For instance, at points, heterosexism has been very destructive to the women's movement and women's ability to work with each other. It's also greatly affected the women's movement ability to deal with other kinds of problems. The other problem is how do these isms continue to perpetuate an economic system that does not allocate resources equitably? And to whose benefit does all of this serve, and the marginal benefits in between? For instance, a white blue-collar worker over in Maryland has something real to lose if a black person moves into his neighborhood and his property value goes down. And I'm not sure whether you'd call his reaction a racist reaction, classist reaction, or is he just plain scared that he's going to lose his investment? And how can we develop definitions as activists which help us deal with those kinds of problems?
As Alex Kate Shulman pointed out at the beginning of this show, it is imperative that people coming of age now understand what went on in the past, to understand the noble utopian ideas, to understand the mistakes, to understand the work that was done and still needs to be done. The women we think of as helping to found the women's movement came from a long tradition of radical women and radical politics. The explosion we saw in the late 60s has not died. The mistakes made still correctable. Cynthia Washington.
I'm tired of elaborating the problem into minutia more than you ever wanted to know about sexism and racism. Nothing about what you do about it. And I guess a part of what I'm getting at is how do we work with each other and come up with a definition that allows people to say, I am a cultural nationalist and a radical feminist and a socialist, all at the same time, without having to run and hide in the black community, be accused of being gay in the heterosexual community, so forth and so on, and in ways that are not threatening to ourselves.
You have been listening to a public affairs presentation of the Sophie's Parlor Media Collective. This has been a retrospect on radical feminism, produced by Moira Rankin and co-produced by Deborah George. Sources for this retrospect, other than original material, include interviews by Deborah George with Alex Kate Schulman, Lorraine Gray, Anne Bolin, and Lynn Goldfarb with the leader of the Women's Emergency Brigade from the film documentary With Babies and Banners, Colin Edwards with Fannie Lou Hamer, Viv Sutherland and Judy Pasternak with the IWY Conference, and Sherry Maeda with Edith Barksdale Sloan. Music featured in this retrospect included performances by Margie Adam, Lucha, Meg Christian, Laura Nero, Willie Tyson, The Joy of Cooking, and LaBelle. Sophie's would also like to thank the following women who advised with this show: Patricia Brett, Sari Feld, Mary Lewis, Sherry Maeda, Deborah Morris, and Carolyn Morrissey. Finally, this retrospect on radical feminism would like to acknowledge the groups that helped to start feminism in the 1970s. Here is Alex Kate Schulman reading from her book Burning Questions and describing the massive women's march held in New York City on August 26, 1970, in honor of women finally getting the vote.
Together for the first time, the National Organization for Women, NOW, who'd organized the march, and Betty Friedan, who'd called for a strike, led off with a car full of aged veteran suffragists, heroes from the first wave of feminism. Behind them came Witch and Bitch and Owl, older women's liberation, and Red Stockings and the feminists and New York radical feminists and us, all pioneers. Then Big Sisters and Black Women's Liberation and the National Coalition of American Nuns and RAT and Radical Lesbians and Gay Activist Alliance and New Yorkers for Abortion Law Repeal and Women in Child Care and Newsreel Women's Caucus and Media Women and Women Artists in Revolution and the Third World Women's Alliance and Spanish American Feminists and Women's Strike for Peace and Jeanette Rankin Rank and File and the YWCA and the Emma Goldman Brigade and the Alice Crimmins Brigade and the Stanton Anthony Brigade and the League of Women Voters and High School Women's Coalition and the Lesbian Food Conspiracy and Betsy Ross Junior High Women's Liberation and Women in Publishing and SCEF Women and CORE Women and SNCC Women and SWP Women and the Young Socialist Alliance and International Socialist Women and Daughters of Bilitis and Half of Brooklyn and It's All Right to Be Woman Theater and Off Our Backs and Up From Under and It Ain't Me Babe and Afra and Lilith and The Group and Multitudes to Obliterate Misogyny and Columbia Barnard Women's Liberation and Queens College Women's Liberation and Brooklyn Woods Women's Liberation and West Side Women United and Westchester Women's Liberation and Bronx Feminists and Revolutionary Child Care Collective and Youth Against War and Fascism and Women of the Venceremos Brigade and Spartacist Women and Maoist Women and National Welfare Rights Organization and Women versus Connecticut and Professional Women's Caucus and Women for Bella Abzug and Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and the Joan Bird Bail Fund and Independent Radical Women's Caucus and hundreds of unidentified women wearing buttons of their own design and hundreds of unaffiliated women carrying signs, and women without labels, and men for women's rights, and a few independent men too. We did it. Without help, without money, without sympathy or government grants, in the face of ridicule and subterfuge, we did the impossible. We came together and created the miraculous beginnings of women's liberation. By will and work and vision, we had altered the course of history. We had affected the consciousness of the world, and now no one in it, not one of us, would ever be the same again.
And that does it for this week's program. From the Vault is produced by Brian DeShazor and Mark Torres. It is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives. Thanks for listening and for keeping our history alive. I'm Lynn Ballen from Feminist Magazine for the Pacifica Radio Archives.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.